Well, please turn with me again tonight to the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 13. There are some people who have a misconception about the Old Testament. They regard it as simply the history of the Jews. And yet, in this history, over and over again, that concerns God's people Israel, you find all kinds of passages that indicate that the God that we are dealing with is the God of the whole earth, the God of every single human being, the God of every living creature. And therefore, tonight we're going to look at a prophecy that Isaiah made against the kingdom of Babylon. And again, this stresses God's supreme authority over not only the nation of Israel, but over all the nations. One of the most unique features you may remember about the prophet Amos is that he stresses God's judgment on all of the nations around about Israel. And he is stressing that all of these nations are accountable to the one God. This is the very reason, of course, that we believe in going into all the world and preaching the gospel to every creature, because we believe that all nations and all peoples in those nations are accountable to the Lord who made heaven and earth. So here, as we begin Isaiah 13, we're beginning a series of predictions about the various nations of Isaiah's time. And this before us tonight is a prediction of the destruction of the future and mighty Babylonian Empire. This kind of prediction is very good for us to read and study because it reminds us, first of all, that all events are appointed by the purpose of God and that He is sovereign over everything. That's always good for us to remember. It also reminds us of what happens to the ungodly and encourages us to persevere in worshiping the one true God. And then it reminds us to positively seek the Lord, to attempt to not sin intentionally against Him, lest He punish with greater severity those who knew their master's will and did it not. This vision that is being talked about here tonight was seen by Isaiah some 200 years before it happened. Isaiah saw it in around 739 BC. It came to pass 200 years later. To put that in the proper perspective, we need only remember that we are just a little over 200 years old as a nation, not yet 250 years old in America. And if someone had predicted an event that would be happening now, and they had predicted it and told about it before the Revolutionary War, we would be amazed at that. Well, this is exactly what was given to Isaiah, that he should know something 200 years before it came to pass. He says in verse 2, "Lift up a banner on the high mountain." And before we go any further, you should know by this time from this recurring image of the banner what a banner is. It's not exactly a flag. It is what? It's a standard. The different tribes of Israel had standards, and they were designed to be tall poles with emblems on them that stood for that particular tribe, so that when it came time for the army to muster, or for the children of Israel to muster to the tribes, that they could look around and they could say, oh, there's our tribe gathering over there, because the standard would be lifted up. So what Isaiah is saying here is, lift up a standard on the high mountain. Actually, God is saying this. Raise your voice to them. We're going to see who them is in just a moment. Raise your voice to them. Wave your hand that they may enter the gates of the nobles. The picture is of a bare hill and someone mustering an army that's going to go down into a notable city through the gates of the nobles and do battle. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger, those who rejoice in my exaltation. Now this is interesting, because the word sanctify or holy ones can easily confuse us here if we do not realize what is going on. What's the primary meaning of sanctify, or even to pronounce something as holy? Set it apart. To set it apart. And so what we're going to find is that these people that God is commanding are very unlikely people to be called sanctified or holy in the sense that you and I use the term. When we speak of someone as holy, when we speak of someone being sanctified, we naturally are thinking of their becoming more and more Christ-like, becoming more and more conformed to the image of Jesus. Or when we speak of something that is sanctified, such as the Lord's Supper on Sunday morning, when we pray a prayer and we ask the Lord to set apart the bread and the fruit of the vine for his use, we are thinking at least in terms of some sort of neutral substance, grape juice that has not been used for any evil purpose, a matzo that has not been used for any anti-Christian use, simply neutral, indifferent food that is common and that we are now, by prayer, asking God to set apart to make it holy for communion. But here, God is talking about something entirely different. He's talking about a group of people that he's set apart. He says he has called them for his anger. Whoever these people are, he's called them for his anger. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger, on account of my anger. Those who rejoice in my exaltation. Now what we're going to find out is that these people do not have in mind God's exaltation at all. But they're going to rejoice over the same thing God rejoices over. They're going to rejoice in God's being exalted over Babylon. So as we come into this picture, it's the picture of God commanding soldiers to lift up a standard, to signal to other soldiers to come in and plunder the city of Babylon. And these soldiers do not even know that they're carrying out the Lord's will. Can you think of some other instances in the Bible where people carried out the Lord's will and they didn't know it? Yes, Pat. Yes, the high priest and Pilate, when they gathered together and condemned the Lord to be crucified, they were defying God in doing that, and yet at the same time, they were doing exactly what the Lord wanted to happen. And in case that seems like a shocking doctrine to you, I'll show you where you can find it in Scripture. Look at Acts chapter 4. The early church is praying, and they're speaking to God here. And they say in verse 24 of Acts 4, "Lord, you are God who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, who by the mouth of your servant David have said, 'Why did the nations rage and the people plot vain things? The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For truly against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, were gathered together to do whatever your hand and your purpose determined before to be done.'" It's an amazing statement. Yes, Michael. Yeah, King Cyrus of Persia permitted the Jews to return to Israel and to rebuild the temple, and God called him my servant. A number of years ago in the pro-life movement, when the pro-life movement was just getting publicly started in Austin, it had been kind of beneath the surface for many years, and finally we began to have marches at the Capitol and public rallies and so on. I was asked to MC a banquet, and the speaker at the banquet was Dr. Bernard Nathanson. Dr. Bernard Nathanson had run an abortion clinic in New York City for many, many years. And he felt that he had personally, if not by his own hands, but that he was personally responsible for some 100,000 abortions over all of the years that he had run the busiest abortion clinic in New York City, which never even closed for Christmas Day. It was open 365 days a year. Bernard Nathanson began to realize that what he was doing was destroying human life. He began to acknowledge what he had publicly repressed in his conscience for a long time. And he began to speak out against abortion. And here he was sitting at our head table about to give a speech, and he was in a room full of Christians. But Dr. Bernard Nathanson was still an atheist. And so as I presented him to the congregation there at the banquet hall, I said, "Dr. Nathan," but I knew that he was a Jew by background, even though he was an atheist, and he knew his Bible. So I said, "Dr. Nathanson, I hope you will permit us this compliment. Even though you do not acknowledge or worship the God that all of these people here acknowledge tonight, and that is the reason they are pro-life, you are like Cyrus in the book of Isaiah, and I hope you will permit us to acknowledge you as God's servant." And he acknowledged that. Now, I'm proud to report to you that Dr. Nathanson is now a Christian. First, he became a theist, and now he has become an evangelical Christian. But at the time, he was like Cyrus the pagan, someone that God could call my servant. And yet at the same time, we had no way of knowing if Dr. Nathanson would ever go to heaven or not, or have a relationship with the Lord. And certainly, we do not suspect good things about the afterlife of Herod or Pilate or the Jews who put Jesus to death, or the Roman soldiers who tossed for his clothing. And yet at the same time, they did whatever the Lord had decreed beforehand should be done. So the point is that this army goes into, is being ordered into the city of Babylon, and it is God's army, God's sanctified ones, God's set apart people. In verse 4, we have a description of this army, and it's made up of all kinds of people. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like that of many people. A tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts musters the army for battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, the Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. Now, speaking of Cyrus, I don't want to give things away too early, but that is exactly who was in command of this army. This army is being commanded by Cyrus, but that's something for us to know tonight. As far as Isaiah is concerned, who's commanding the army? The Lord. The Lord's commanding the army. The Lord of hosts musters the army for battle. The Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. So Cyrus is in command, but this army is controlled by the Lord. Then when you get to verse 6, it says, "Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore all hands will be limp. Every man's heart will melt, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames." Okay. There are two ways to interpret this passage. It says the day of the Lord is at hand. What do all of you understand the day of the Lord to be? Judgment day. Okay? So this is in interpretation one, Isaiah speaking in terms of an army commanded by Cyrus but led by the Lord, wreaking destruction on Babylon. Then he switches to a future time where he speaks of the ultimate final judgment of God, the day of the Lord is at hand. And that is one way of looking at the passage, that it is a kind of prophetic foreshortening where, as it were, Isaiah sees two mountaintops, one close, one distant, and he describes one near and one further away. But there's another way of looking at the passage. Can you guess what it might be? One can be simply Isaiah switches from now to then and back to now. But there's another way. Yeah. In other words, the day of the Lord happens more than once in the sense that God's judgments begin in this life. And God's judgments that we receive in this life are foretastes of the day of the Lord. Just as we have been pointing out that the blessings of the future have begun now, so future judgment has begun now. You see, the book of Romans, as you know, begins with the fact that God's wrath is being poured out and God's judgment is being poured out right now. And it is a foretaste and a forerunner of the judgment to come. And the way God's judgment is being poured out now in Romans 1 is that God gives people up to what they want. But also God's future judgment is foreshadowed, and we're given a taste of it in events that happen in this life. So part of the future day of the Lord, which hasn't even arrived yet, is an event that happened back in 539 BC. The day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will be limp, every man's heart will melt, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another, and their faces will be like flames. Somebody explain to me the phrase, their faces will be like flames. Why are they going to be red-faced? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's the sense of the amazement part. They're going to be amazed. They're going to look at each other with horror. But there's a specific significance to their faces being red because, you know, I've seen scared people before. Their faces are pale. Exactly. Exactly. They will blush because they know what the judgment is for. They will blush because they know what the judgment is for. Behold, verse 9 says, behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. Now look at verse 10. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Here is where we get into a certain kind of language that is very important for us to take note of because it obviously cannot be taken literally here if it is being if it's talking about a coming destruction of Babylon. Now obviously it can be taken literally if it's talking about only the future judgment of God. But before we figure out exactly how it should be taken, why should there be this kind of reaction by God against stars of heaven and the sun and the moon? Why should these things have anything to do with sin or what's going on earth? Yes, Carol? Okay, that can certainly be one explanation. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that is I think a good suggestion that these things that were worshipped are going to be completely knocked down and triumphed over by God. Any others? Bob?
Well, light and darkness have always been compared to sin and good.
Yes.
And in a place where the sinners are going to be, there is not going to be light.
Yes. Exactly right. Okay. And Max, what were you about to say? Okay. In other words, it has something to do with the darkness of the sin. It also has something to do with the darkness of judgment. Because don't forget that when Adam sinned, the whole creation fell. Not only the kingdom of men and the kingdom of animals, but the kingdom of nature fell too. And so therefore, one day we look forward to a time when paradise will be completely restored. But until that time, this entire creation is fallen. And when God judges in mighty power and judgment, he not only judges human beings, but he judges creation as well. And so the Bible speaks of nature empathizing with what is happening to mankind, both negatively and later on positively. Do you remember a lovely passage in Isaiah chapter 55, verse 12, where it says, you shall go out with joy and be led out with peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth into singing before you, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. This is a good passage for those who say, I take the Bible literally. You know, first of all, for a tree to clap its hands, it's got to have two. Okay? Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress tree, instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree, and so on. Here is nature not only rejoicing with God's word, but you have nature in the passage before us being judged along with human beings. Now there's a place in the New Testament where it talks about nature's empathy with us. Where's that, Andrew? Romans 8. For the whole creation is waiting for the revealing of you, the sons of God, the sons and daughters of God. For the creation was subject to futility. So it's cursed along with us, and its fortune is bound up with our fortune. Yes, Ralph, what were you going to say?
Just because you got the same end, because in the beginning when man had fallen, God did curse the earth. So it has to be flourished, it has to be cleansed. And
that's right.
It's waiting in agony too, because it wants to be restored.
Absolutely right. Now here is, there's a couple things I want to show you about this business of the cosmic powers of the stars, the sun, and the moon being darkened and so on. If you turn over to Matthew 24, verse 29, here's Jesus in the midst of prophesying about what's going to happen in A.D. 70 to the Jews who have rejected him as their Messiah. Matthew 24, 29. He's prophesying nothing less than the end of Judaism. He is actually saying that God's people, as publicly constituted as the covenant people, the Jews, will no longer be his people. Judaism will no longer be recognized. When Titus and the Roman soldiers come into Jerusalem, they will actually destroy the necessary means of drawing nigh to God. They will destroy the temple and not leave one stone standing upon another. In the middle of all that, Jesus says this, Matthew 24, 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Here's the same language as Isaiah 13. And yet, it's going to happen within the generation to whom Jesus was speaking. Verse 34. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. So here's a lesson for us in our Bible study. Sometimes there is very highly poetic and very overwrought language that shows the intensity of God's judgment against a nation. And when Jesus was speaking here to his disciples, he was telling them the same kind of judgment that God did in 539 to Babylon, he is about to do within 40 years to Jerusalem. And the same kinds of intense things are going to happen. Stars fall from heaven, powers of the heavens will be shaken. These are highly symbolic things. And they have to do with God's judgment. Now let me try to make this even clearer if I can. What natural thing happened when Jesus was crucified? There was an earthquake and the sun was darkened. Yeah, Luke chapter 23, verses 44 and 45. We read that it was about the sixth hour and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. Then the sun was darkened and the veil of the temple was torn in two. There has been speculation that it was an eclipse. Yeah. If you ever have a chance to see on television or someplace the first 5 minutes of the movie Barabbas, see it. It's not a very good movie. But the first 5 minutes are phenomenal. Then you can turn it off and watch something else. It's Anthony Quinn in Barabbas. The reason the first 5 minutes are phenomenal is that they got everything set up to film the crucifixion during an eclipse of the sun. And they did it. They filmed the crucifixion with an eclipse of the sun, and it is fantastic. And then, you know, you've seen all there is to see that's worthwhile in Barabbas. Okay, verse 11 back in Isaiah 13. I will punish the world for its evil. Here everything has increased. In other words, this punishment of Babylon is a type of the punishment of the whole world. This is a general statement about all judgment. I will, yes, brother, excuse me.
Matthew 24 is talking about
Yeah.
Is that saying that that is the fulfillment of this passage?
No. It's saying it's using language, it's using the same kind of language used to describe this passage. It's using the language of judgment. That's all I'm saying. Well, it's not quite all I'm saying. It isn't quite all I'm saying, but I didn't want to say all that you're wanting me to say right now. All right, Max. Yes. Now, to go on to...
What three-letter
word? That's right. What Max just wormed out of me is that I believe... Now, don't run screaming from the room when I tell you this, but I believe... And I would have told you this at the end of the study tonight, so it's just not now, Max, but I believe that the great passage in Revelation about the destruction of Babylon in Revelation chapter 17 is speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem. You know why? Because after Babylon has fallen, then John looks up and he sees a new Jerusalem. Ever thought about that? So the point is that this is not something that we should break fellowship over or anything. It just means that as we get to the end of our Bibles, I think that apostate Jerusalem who has rejected its Messiah is the ultimate Babylon. And yes, I'm one of those people that believes that most of Revelation is about the coming destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So, now that I've showed my hand, let's go back to Isaiah 13:11. I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. Now, these are some general principles. I will halt the arrogance of the proud, and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a mortal more rare than fine gold, a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. Ophir was a source of gold. Solomon got gold from there. You see, what's being said in verse 12 is the same doctrine that we've seen in Isaiah all along, but stated a little differently. It's the doctrine of the remnant. There is a remnant that will be saved. Not everyone will be saved, but there is a faithful remnant that will be. Verse 13, therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place, in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. We know from 2 Peter that a time is coming in the future when the day of the Lord will come. This is 2 Peter 3:10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. So, we will live one day on a renovated earth under a new heaven, and this is all part of the day of judgment. It says in verse 14, it shall be as the hunted gazelle, and as a sheep that no man takes up, a sheep without a shepherd. In other words, he is returning to the specific manifestation of judgment that the Babylonians are going to be fleeing. He says, every man will turn to his own people, everyone will flee to his own land. Now, the destruction gets very cruel here. The destruction gets very savage because the people who did destroy Babylon in 539 and overrun Babylon were very savage and cruel people. This is what was so amazing, that their leader Cyrus was actually used by the Lord to bring the Jews back But in 15 and 16, we read, everyone who's found will be thrust through, everyone who's captured will fall by the sword, their children also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes, their houses will be plundered, their wives ravished. Cruel warfare here. And now, in verse 17, Isaiah finally reveals who this army is. And it's really best to read it in the New International Version because of the way it still maintains the element of surprise. So you have your NIV there, Ralph. Okay, read verse 17.
See, I will stir up against them the Medes who will not care for silver and have no delight in gold.
Okay, you're supposed to have a kind of a gasp there. See, I will stir up against them the Medes. The Medes. This is the army. These are the sanctified ones, the ones set apart by God for this one work only, to destroy the ungodly nation of Babylon. God dealt with a ruler of Babylon some years before this destruction happened. Do you remember who that ruler was? This ruler is the one who said about God, his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? That was not said by a saint, but by one of the worst sinners in the Bible, and yet it was true words about God. Who said that? Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar said that after God did what to him? He drove him insane. He took his mind from him. And why did he do that? Because of his abundant pride. The whole story is told in the fourth chapter of Daniel. And if you want to kind of get the key to the chapter, it's in 425, where Daniel warns Nebuchadnezzar, they shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he will. Nebuchadnezzar had pride in his kingdom because he thought that his kingdom would last forever. He was thrilled with his hanging gardens. He was thrilled with his great conquests. And God took his mind from him, so that he would eventually come back to his senses and he would give glory to God. Now, here is the sobering thing about Nebuchadnezzar's confession. Do you realize that Nebuchadnezzar, as far as we know, was never converted? He never had a change of heart. This is how far one can go on a mere profession of faith, that you can confess, all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? That was enough for Nebuchadnezzar's reason to come back. But it was not enough to take Nebuchadnezzar to heaven. Nebuchadnezzar had to have personal, lifelong trust and faith in this God instead of giving him the lip service that is due him. His heart had to match his confession. God is punishing Babylon for all of its atrocities, punishing Babylon for its pride, and he's using a very wild and barbaric people who had been conquered by the Persians, and that's why you read about the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. The Medes were from northwest Iran, and they had joined the Babylonians to defeat the Assyrians, but then they united with the Persians to conquer Babylon. And Cyrus was commanding them. So they are going to go on with great cruelty. It says in verse 19, "And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah." What's the first mention of Babylon in the Bible that you know about? The Tower of Babel in the Plain of Shinar. Yeah. The place where they attempted to be equal to God and build a tower to the heavens. The place where God confounded their languages and scattered them on the face of the earth because they were gathering together for defiance of Him. And so all through the Scriptures, Babylon was virtually symbolic for enmity with God. Now, in view of that, John, as I said earlier, says in the 17th chapter of Revelation that the great city of Babylon is going to be overthrown someday. And so I want to mention to you that the interpretation that I leaked out tonight, that I believe in, that it's symbolic language for Judaism and its deadness and its defiance of God and its refusal to trust in Jesus. I want to say to you that there is another view completely. As a matter of fact, there have been two other views that have held sway among evangelical Christians.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now to continue listening.
I want to say to you that there is another view completely. As a matter of fact, there have been two other views that have held sway among evangelical Christians. One view is that Babylon is the Roman Catholic Church. It is the false religious system that has been set up to thwart the faith of God's elect. And so you'll find many commentators who believe that the last Babylon is the Roman system. You will also find some other commentators that believe in the rise of a literal Babylon. Anybody recognize the picture on the cover of this paperback? Saddam Hussein. But there's another picture alongside him, and that is Nebuchadnezzar. And the reason for this is that when Saddam Hussein is not harassing the nations round about and causing problems, he is actually trying to excavate and rebuild the city of Babylon in Iraq. And here is a poster for the Babylon International Festival that was held in 1987, and it features dual portraits, a medal here, of Saddam Hussein and Nebuchadnezzar. And he is trying to emulate Nebuchadnezzar and reconstruct many of the ancient buildings of Babylon. So there is a school of Bible prophecy that believes that I and others like me are wrong, wrong, wrong about Revelation 17, and that Revelation 17 does talk about a literal Babylon that is going to rise on the same archaeological site as ancient Babylon, and God is going to finally destroy it, and it's going to, you know, be a major economic and military power again. Here is why I don't believe it will happen. Verse 20. It will never be inhabited. Nor will it be settled from generation to generation. Nor will the Arabian pitch tents there. Nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls, ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there, the hyenas will howl in their citadels, and jackals in their pleasure palaces. Her time is near to come. Just 200 years in the Lord's reckoning, and her days will not be prolonged. So, the point is that all of this was fulfilled, as John Calvin recognized centuries ago, over a long period of time. But by the 7th century A.D., no wall of Babylon was left standing. And even if Saddam Hussein should recreate it, God will, I believe, see that Isaiah chapter 13, verses 20 through 22 are not fulfilled. So let me close tonight, regardless of what you believe about the future Babylon of Revelation 17. Here is one way we can all close ranks and believe the same thing. If you'll turn with me to Daniel 5 in closing, I want you just to see a famous story. Belshazzar made a feast. In the middle of his feast, in verse 5, it says, "In the same hour the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other." King James says, "His knees smote one against the other." And an inscription was written by the hand, and Daniel was called to explain the inscription. But before he explained the inscription, he reminded Belshazzar about his father Nebuchadnezzar. He said in verse 18, "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." And so at the end, it says, this is the interpretation. Verse 26. "Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tikal, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians." I want you to think of those verbs for just a minute. Your kingdom has been divided. Your kingdom has been given. Who's the subject? The unspoken subject who divided the kingdom and gave it to somebody. God. God did it. It's given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Who did he receive it from? God. Because Darius is another title for Cyrus. Darius the Mede. Well, that's a controversy. I won't state that dogmatically, but that is my opinion, that Darius is another title for Cyrus. Darius the Mede received the kingdom being about 62 years old. This was the beginning of the end, the beginning of the fulfillment of Isaiah 13. This was a type of God's judgment to come. Brothers and sisters, it is wonderful to serve a God who is in absolute charge of who rules and who is put down, who sets up kings and puts down kingdoms, and yet whose eye is on the sparrow. Not a sparrow falls to the ground without your Father in heaven's will. And so, as you and I serve our God and love Him and seek His face, let us remember that He is the God who is sovereign over who rules over us. He is the God who is sovereign over all nations. And He is sovereign over every single detail of our lives as well. Any final questions or comments? earthly rulers are no match for the heavenly king.
Thank you for listening to this tape. We hope you enjoyed it and benefited from it. If you'd like a catalog of more tapes from Dayspring Chapel, write to us. Write to Dayspring Tapes, 5500 Avenue G, Austin, Texas, 78751. That's Dayspring Tapes, 5500 Avenue G, Austin, Texas, 78751. The catalog will be sent to you free of charge.